Okay, so thank you very much for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. I was just speaking to my wife in Boston, and she said that they had to turn on the heat because my kids were cold, so the weather is much more pleasant here. Huh? It's 40s in Boston, supposedly. So in the past 7 months in my lab, we had this period where everything worked magically, and of course 7 months of some fruitful time is probably going to be followed by a long famine, but I was very conflicted about what to talk about today. So I thought about, you know, kind of summarizing everything that we are working on, but those talks that try to combine multiple talks never work. So I decided to just give one slide overview of everything and then just focus on one subject area that we had a lot of results on. So one area we work on is helical filaments. So if you have a bacteria, it has this very nice flagella, and you can just shear this flagella off, and you get very nice filaments that can be either in helical form or straight form. There's 13 different polymorphic transitions. And the question we are interested in is, how is the behavior of a helical filament different from that of a straight filament? And for example, you can take a helical filament and you can see that its rheology, its viscosity is much higher than that of a straight filament, or you can study its dynamics or its self-assembly. So I mean, there's a lot of polymer experts in the audience. I don't know if people have thought about that from a theoretical perspective all that much. And then there's also very interesting questions of how these things assemble into bundles, because they have curvature that's non-trivial, and so they can't really crystallize.
They're all left.
You can have left-handed polymorphs, and you can have right-handed polymorphs.
But from bacteria, they're all left?
No, you have 13 different polymorphs, and some of them are left-handed, and some of them are right-handed. And they're very well controlled.
The friction is large, not the viscosity, yeah.
I mean, it's just, it doesn't flow, right? If I have a filament like this, a solution of this helical filaments, this stuff doesn't flow. It has a very large viscoelastic properties. If I prepare the same filaments, same concentration, same contour length, everything is the same. The only difference is that this is a helical filament and this is a straight filament. And so this is, you know, 5 mg/mL or something like that. So it's a gel. And the dynamic, you know, two helical filaments can entangle with themselves, while two straight filaments cannot. So the second area that we are very interested in, and that's going to be very important for my talk, is friction in filaments. So the simple experiment that's actually technically very difficult to do is, you take two filaments, we attach them to a laser tweezer, and we have polymer that's exerting an osmotic pressure on these filaments. And then we ask a very simple question of, you know, so people have studied to a great extent what is the intermolecular potential as you vary the osmotic pressure for CEN and co-workers. We ask a different question: what happens when you apply a force in this direction? What is the force required to slide two filaments past one another? And this is an example of an experiment that we do. So you have two filaments here, you have two beads, two filaments attached to a bead, and you make this kind of complex, and then you just apply a force, and you measure what is, you know, as you slide them, you measure the force required to slide these filaments past one another.
So you have crosslinks there?
No, it's just osmotic pressure from the polymer, so we can control how fast they're pushed against one another.
Can you describe how they go from obviously flow conditions to overlapping? Could you describe
that? So you just apply a flow by moving the stage.
Yeah.
And so you can see that they're flopping around.
And one of them turned around.
Yeah, and then very quickly, one of them attaches to another bead, and then we click quickly reverse the flow, and they...
Okay. I was going to say, depletion forces alone aren't going to make it.
No. Okay.
So if it's attached to the second bead, then you disattach it or something?
No, then we just slide it. Then we just push this bead at a certain velocity V, and we ask what is the force on this bead?
As a function of pressure.
As a function of pressure and as a function of velocity.
So it's a Coulomb law or dry friction?
Yeah, it varies for different filaments. It varies by 3-4 orders of magnitude. And so, you know, we have a lot of nice data that we don't understand. And I would like to talk to people. In certain limits, you observe. In certain limits, you observe, you know, that it's logarithmic on velocity. Logarithmically, the force depends logarithmically on velocity, and it's independent of the overlap length, above some critical.
It's logarithmic with velocity. Can you extract some kind of, you know, barrier?
Because yeah, we're trying to do that. Behavior. Yes, I mean. Yeah.
How do you separate friction between filaments from friction with the surroundings?
I mean, this friction can be up to 100 piconewtons. It's a huge force. So, you know, dragging a single filament is a femtonewton or something. It's not measurable in our setup.
Is it proportional to pressure?
Yeah, it is, yes.
So it's Coulomb law.
To a certain extent, in certain limits. I can show you the data.
But Coulomb law is independent of velocity. Yeah.
So right, but logarithmic.
It's logarithmic.
It's completely like logarithmic, right.
The third part that we're working on is beating of flagella. So here you have this very nice filament that just oscillating in time, right? So it's a biological oscillator. It's an enormously complicated structure. It has 650 components, and some people have argued that, you know, that this thing is irreducibly complex in US especially, and that therefore, you know, evolution is not complete or something like that. But what we've been able to do in the lab is we've been able to take few components and assemble an in vitro bundle that just spontaneously beats as a function of time. And so this is going to continue for hours. The period of oscillation is different by an order of magnitude or up to two orders of magnitude. But still, there is kind of resemblances between this beating and this beating. And so we are interested in, you know, is it a similar mechanism? Is it completely different mechanism between this kind of in minimal model system and a biological model system?
So it's beating much faster in vitro?
No, in vivo. This is you know 60 hertz, and this is, you know, one oscillation per 10 seconds or something like that. So it's too. It's accelerated here because this is actually in minutes. Now, if you have one oscillator, you can, you know, collect them on a surface, and then you can get interactions between multiple oscillators. So you get metachronal waves, right? So here you can see these beating oscillators, and they propagate. You know, you can see these beating patterns that propagate in this direction, and here they propagate in this direction. So this is very similar to what's happening. You know, metachronal waves are important for propulsion of various algae that live in ponds around here, and as well as, you know, in your lungs are lined up with these synchronously beating waves, and that's how you clear mucus out of the lungs.
Is this by your design? Or
yeah, this is, we just put the individual components. We assemble these components on the interface. And so there's maybe 7-8 components
here. You design these waves? Waves are spontaneous.
No, these are spontaneously beating, and then if this flagella is beating and its neighbors, then they synchronize.
Self-organize,
yes.
What is the surface? Is that a vesicle?
No, this is actually an air interface. And so this is made out of microtubules. And so the microtubules, for some reason, really lodge themselves at this interface, and they create these bundles. And then you add motors and some depletant, and they organize into this pattern. It was a completely accidental discovery, but, you know.
What's the species you might have mentioned from which you derived the flagella?
This is not real flagella.
No, I know, but the previous movie that you showed, these are the components, right?
No, this is just, we take here, mm-hmm. We just take microtubules, motors, certain other components, and we just add it up. It attaches to the interface, and it starts beating spontaneously. It's completely in vitro, yes. This is 650 components, and doing genetics on this is very difficult. You know, people spend a lot of time to engineer one knockout mutant, study its structure. but it's very different from this bottom-up assembly. And this actually shows that it's maybe oscillations are very generic to these active bundles, that it's not some kind of very fine, precise mechanism that, and you know, and there's theories by the French group of Ulliker and Prost that have, you know, indicated something like that.
What kind of
are you using for your Kinesians? Yes. And so the fork.
But in the other one, is Dynin.
The other one, no, this is all Kinesian. Dynins are very difficult to work at.
It's I mean biological.
Biological ones. So we actually change everything about the system. We change the motor proteins, we change the interactions, we change, you know, from this very highly structured protein to something very disorganized. And you still observe the same behavior. So that might be saying that, you know, physics is going on as opposed to biochemistry.
At least in the C, I know that there is this typical structure of the bundle, of the microtubule bundle.
Yeah.
So do you, in your in vitro self-assembly, do you know, I mean, there is just seven.
No, it's just a disorganized bundle.
So you say it's...
And it can have from 5 microtubules to 100 microtubules, and it flaps.
Similar thickness?
No, very much lower frequency.
No, but it depends on the size of the bundle.
Yeah, the bundle size actually doesn't determine the frequency. It's only the length. So then the final thing that we are interested in is models of cytoplasmic streaming. So, you know, sometimes you have these very large cells and you have these very large components and you have to get from part A to part B, and it's cytoskeletal, you know, Brownian diffusion is not very, very efficient in taking this bead and making it here. So cells have evolved the mechanisms that are called cytoplasmic steering that essentially, you know, stir up the mixture and make it, you know, mix it up at a much faster length scale than what it would take with Brownian diffusion. So again, so this is our minimal kind of model system of cytoplasmic streaming without any ATP. And then if you add ATP, you can see that, you know, you get this kind of freely flowing state where the beads are just spontaneously moving. And so if you do the mean square displacement, you can actually tune it from subdiffusive to something that's freely flowing or ballistic.
But this is motors or not?
Yeah, this is motors again. So this is, you know, this is an active mixture.
But are these motors carrying particles or are
this is a gel that organizes into a freely flowing state, and these are not attached to the motors. These are just passive particles that are indicating what is the flow profile of your gel.
So it's the fluid streamline, basically.
Yes, yes.
So it consists of what?
It again consists of microtubules, you know, some depletant agent, motor proteins, and things like that. Microtubule gels seem to behave very differently from actin gels, in that they are, you know, that they are not contractile.
Do people think that in vivo this reflects what happens?
There's actually an interesting paper that talks about Drosophila embryos that are very large, and during the 10B development stage of Drosophila embryo, you turn on the assembly of microtubule motors, and you get this very active cytoplasmic streaming that looks very like something like what we see here.
Think about the microtubules as forming some kind of a solid gel, or
I can show you a movie later on. I haven't included it. I mean, it's bundles, but instead of bundles contracting, these bundles extend, so they are extensile, and then they encounter another bundle, and they spontaneously merge, and this process goes on. We can keep this going on for 24 to 48 hours. So
these kinesins, do they do filaments, or is that kind of single kinesins?
These are these clusters of kinesins that have been,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, you need to have clusters yes, to obviously. Push two motors against one another.
But in vivo, in cells, I thought when people operate these particles, they see almost normal diffusion.
And you would see this as well if you look at longer time scale. At longer distance scale, it becomes
normal. There's some work that's shown super diffusion in cells by John Crocker. And so here we can go from, you know, we can tune from subdiffusive to, so we have the control over all the parameters. So again, you know, I would be very interested if somebody has ideas of what are really the quantities to measure.
Largest scale, it will still become diffusive again.
Yeah, we don't have the times. I mean, I think everything becomes diffusive eventually. But
real diffusion, because it's sort of active.
Yes.
Because it's random at larger scales, there's no.
I mean, we'll see. It's just completely ballistic over the time scales we have access to. What happens on larger time scales, I don't know, and larger length scales.
It's really exponent 2, no?
It's 1.98 or something like that. Okay. 1 point and
but
2 point.
These particles are small, so they can actually penetrate through the mesh, I believe.
Well, the mesh is completely fluidized at this point. And so the. Yes.
They form a mesh.
Yes.
Okay. These particles are smaller than the mesh.
No, there is no mesh. There is no mesh.
Solid mesh. No solid mesh. Don't understand. Sorry.
It falls apart.
It's a complete mesh.
I can show you a movie later on. Okay, so you know, so those are some kind of, you know, I think there's interesting theoretical questions in each one of these areas, and you know, if somebody has any suggestions, I would.
An obvious difference between microtubules and actin, of course, is they can support compression.
Yes.
Which could give you these extensile or tractile fluctuations. Do you think that's basically the main, the key difference?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't, you know, I recently was visiting Margaret Gerdell, and she has, with a postdoc Martin Lenz, I think they have a paper that says that everything should be contractile. Or,
no, but that's with actin, and therefore, I mean, buckling occurs very easily.
I mean, I really don't have any good understanding of why these things are always extensile, but they lead to very different properties. So anyways, this is, you know, so the main subject of my talk is equilibrium self-assembly, right? And so in soft matter, there's a couple of kind of paradigms of a self-assembling system. The simplest one is hard spheres, which form a crystalline phase. Something I've been studying in for a long time is rod-like particles, which make liquid crystalline particles. And kind of the common theme of all these assembly pathways is that they always assemble into kind of, in solution, they'll assemble into three-dimensional structures that are, you know, three-dimensional crystals or liquid crystals and so on and so forth. If you want to do two-dimensional assembly or one-dimensional assembly, you will often have, you'll often make, you know, something that's chemically heterogeneous, that's amphiphilic. So you have a hydrophobic tail, a hydrophilic head, and that will assemble into a membrane-like structure. And then if you control the size of the head and the tail, you can either get a mice cell or a worm-like mice cell. And so that's what people have, this kind of strategy is what they've employed extensively to assemble two-dimensional or, you know, self-limited structures. And so what I'd like to show you today is that perhaps you can take this kind of simple hard particle fluids and still assemble two-dimensional or one-dimensional or zero-dimensional structures. And what's important is the entropy of the system and its chirality. So before I forget, this work was done by a postdoc, Thomas Gibault, and a grad student who recently graduated at Berry. And Mark has just joined our group and started working on these experiments. So the outline is, my talk has three parts. The first part is entropy-driven self-assembly of two-dimensional non-amphiphilic membranes. So this is going to be very brief. The second part I really want to focus on is what is the structure and the energetics of the edge of a membrane and how I can use chirality to control this line tension. And then in part three, I just want to show you some very interesting pi wall defects that we observe in two-dimensional membranes. So as for a lot of things that we use in our research, we utilize these virus particles, and they're 1 micron long, they're semi-flexible, their persistence length can be tuned from 2 to 10 microns. Most of the work I'll show you is for wild type virus, which is 2.8 microns persistence length. And it's monodispersed. So unlike most other systems, this is a monodispersed system. And so that has considerable advantages. And that's why I think we see a lot of the phenomena.
How do you turn the persistence
length? We have some mutants that have different persistence length. So it's very of the code protein.
Is that a mechanical tuning, if you like? Mechanical persistence length bending?
Yes,
or
yes.
Or the defects along the backbone?
No, this is, we do the fluctuation analysis and...
So they're still rod-like?
They're still rod-like, and it's very sensitive. You do a single point mutation of the code protein, and you can change the persistence length 400%. So we don't understand how this thing assembles and how you determine the coarse-grained properties from single particle fluid.
Is that long because there is a single nucleic acid inside that's covered?
Yeah, there's a single nucleic acid, that's, and the length is determined by the nucleic acid.
It's single-stranded?
Single-stranded DNA virus, mm-hmm. Yes. So what we do is we take these rods at very dilute concentration, 1 mg per mL, something, and we add non-absorbing polymer. You can add any kind of non-absorbing polymer. It seems to be very robust, polyethylene glycol, dextran. And so what you get is you get this attractive potential between the rods because of the excluded volume overlaps, overlap of excluded volume. And the nice thing is that you can control the strength of this interaction by controlling the concentration of the osmotic pressure. Now, rods aggregate in a very different way than spheres, right? The spheres, the only thing that matters is the average separation between the particles. For rods, what matters is the average separation between the particles and the orientation between the particles. So two rods will want to sit in this kind of configuration. This is going to be the minimal energy configuration. If I slide them in this direction, that's going to cost me energy.
Are they charged?
They're charged. We add a lot of salt to screen.
Oh, you always use salted valves?
Yes.
Charged negatively?
Yes, as everything else. So if you add polyethylene glycol, at some point, these viruses, they really don't want to mix with the background polymer, and they'll start aggregating. And the way they'll aggregate is they'll aggregate into these very small disc-like structures, right? So this is a disc that's one rod length thick. This is a disc viewed sideways. This is a disc viewed from the top. So all the rods point into the plane of the screen here. Now what's interesting is that now you have discs, right, that are still suspended in the background isotropic solution. So for the same reason that rods want to aggregate laterally, discs want to stack up on top of one another. That's just... It's just kinetics, this happens very quickly. Very quickly, all the rods diffuse into these clusters, right? But then you have these clusters that move very slowly.
So why wouldn't they stick if they're colored or lateral? If the two discs come together, why would...
Well, I mean, I'm just saying they might stick like this, but interaction energy is much stronger if they stick face on.
This question, are they all discs same or...
No.
Okay, that's...
And the size of the disc presumably will depend on concentration?
Yes. The concentration of the filaments and so at some point, at very high depletant concentrations, the discs are going to stack up on top of one another to make this kind of filamentous structure. So you actually end up with a smectic phase in the isotropic background suspension, right?
Those are all the same size.
Yes, when they stack up, then they can smoothen out the edges. Now what's surprising is we lower the polymer concentration and we no longer observe this transition, right? So we see these discs and we actually take laser tweezers and we try to push them, stick them on top of one another, and they don't want to stick. No, you can directly tweeze these things because they are just like a particle.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to stick in this direction, but of course nothing is preventing them from continually sticking laterally And so over time, you'll actually see that you get these giant monolayers that can be tens, hundreds of microns in diameter. They can be, we've had some very nice samples where these monolayers have been a centimeter in size. And so this is, again, a monolayer of rods viewed from the top. This is a monolayer of rods viewed from the side. Okay? So the question is, you know, it's a very robust assembly. I've actually seen these things, you know, 10 years ago, and then we really tried to clean up the system to make this assembly very robust.
Hmm? In the picture below, you have some
this?
Which, yeah, looks like that. I mean,
this is the sideway view of a membrane.
Right, but what is that?
What is the roof?
That's just the shade that's imaging that's out of focus. It's probably a membrane that's a slight angle. So this is a typical good sample. How will it look like? So you have these membranes. You can see that they're fluctuating quite a bit. Then you can fluorescently label 1 out of 10,000 rods, and you can see these rods fluctuate around. They appear as dots because these rods point into the plane of the screen, right? And so there's a lot of information that one can extract from a system like this. You know, you can study the fluctuations and things like that.
Small density, but here density is large because they deposited on something.
They eventually, because they are so heavy, they are large, they will sediment to the bottom of the sample.
There is a clean solution between us and...
Yes.
When suspended, do you see significant bending fluctuations?
Yes, you can measure the bending fluctuations. You can do all that kind of stuff.
And that's why they don't stick properly, because of the calculation.
Yes. So the question is, you know, why are they stable? So one measurement that we did is shown over here. So we have a membrane in a sideways configuration, and you have a fluorescently labeled individual rod. And these rods will, of course, do something like this. There will also be continuum wavelength fluctuations, but there will be single molecule fluctuations, so-called protrusion interactions. And the magnitude of this protrusion interaction is going to be determined by the concentration of the surrounding polymer. So if the concentration of the surrounding polymer is very high, it's very hard for this rod to pop in and out. If the concentration is low, this rod can easily fluctuate up and down, right? So I can control the roughness of this interface by controlling the polymer concentration length. So here we have some, this.
You mean after you assemble the monolayer, then after that you can change the polymer concentration to?
No, this is actually done just reassembling it at different concentrations and just measuring. And so this is a mean square displacement in Z direction as a function of time for In a stack of membranes, you can see that there is almost no fluctuations in Z directions. But for a single membrane, you can see that there is significant Z fluctuations in Z direction at a single particle level.
How do they compare the fluctuations to the length of these particles?
It's maybe 10%. And so the picture that we have is that at very high polymer concentrations, you have very smooth surface. So there's going to be the attraction between the rods is going to dominate, and that's going to lead to the adhesion of the monolayers. At small polymer concentration, at low polymer concentration, the surface is very rough, and then there's an additional entropic repulsion between the monolayers, and the attraction, the range of the attraction is only set by, it's at most the size of the polymer radius of gyration, but the repulsion can be tuned arbitrary, right? And so the only question is this going to melt into, whether a smectic is going to melt into an ematic or whether it's going to unbind and make these monolayers?
So can you measure actually by tuning the pressure the effective potential between the two layers?
What we are trying to do is have two line traps and just bring them together and measure the function and do that experiment in a controlled way.
Because that's a long-standing unresolved issue, how healthy fluctuations go over in incoherent protrusion forces.
Yeah, so here healthy fluctuations are, you know, the bending rigidity of these membranes is huge because they're so thick.
We only have
so those are not really important at this separation.
It's not healthy, this stuff.
Yeah. The white line is a fluctuation. The white line on your plot on the right, top right.
Yeah. Yes.
These are the fluctuations you're talking about.
These are just the mean square displacement of a single particle doing something like
the
that.
The top one is a single particle.
Yeah, this is for a in stack of membranes. So it's completely suppressed.
Oh, it's still a single particle, but it's in a stack.
Yes. Okay, so this is, you know, so you can do a lot of kind of traditional lipid bilayer physics. You can show that, you know, the continuum properties are very similar to those of lipid bilayers. So I think what's new in this part is that you really can get, I think, self-assembly of two-dimensional membranes from something that's homogeneous structurally. It's a very simple, arguably a very simple system of just hard rods and polymers. And it's completely driven by entropy. So in the second part of my talk, I just want to focus on what is the structure of the edge, right? In lipid bilayers, you don't see exposed edges very frequently, but here we see a lot of exposed edges. And so,
it seems to me that this kind of protrusion, it's a bit like surface tension fluctuations. So it has so the roughness would, for example, would not increase like H is not going like L in like in bending energy, but maybe like log L. And so it's things probably could, so it shouldn't have too long range actually.
Yeah, no, it's yeah. Very short range, but the attractive potential is also short range.
Actually, it's funny because years ago we employed a similar mechanism to try to understand surface.
I know.
What
yes. It's very similar.
Yeah.
Is it linear in pressure? The
we don't have quantitative data to really say that at this point.
So that basically goes up.
I've read those papers and I thought about the similarities. So okay, so what is the structure of the edge, right? So you have a membrane. You might think that the membrane just ends in a structure like this, right? But usually, what this costs is there's an interfacial area, right? And this is a very large interfacial area between the polymer and the rods, right? And so usually you have a spherical droplet, so you might want to have you might have an alternative configuration, and that configuration is shown over here, right? So here you have a curved edge, and this edge is curved, and so you minimize this interfacial area, but what it costs, it costs you bending energy, right? So to pack the rods within this kind of edge, you need to tilt the rods. And so what is, and this are just the two extreme cases, right? And so what is the structure of the edge, really? So you can get a clue by looking at single label filaments. You can see in the bulk, they just appear as dots, but you can see at the edges here, they really, when they come to the edge, they appear slightly tilted. Right? And so that would indicate that that's case B, right?
You have to be young to see that.
Okay, I'll show you convincingly in 1 second. If they are tilted at the edge, there's going to be some birefringence associated with that. Here, the index of refraction in both directions is the same. If they're tilting at the edge, there's going to be a birefringence associated with that. So we have a special pole scope, which tells you quantitatively what is the birefringence of each point in the sample, right? And so here again, you can see the bulk is black, which means the two-dimensional projection of the birefringence is zero, which means that all the molecules point into the plane of the screen. And then you have the edges, which light up. And that's saying that the rods are tilting in one or the other direction. And this is actually achiral rods, so they're equally likely to tilt in either direction. And I will not talk about that.
Okay, but this would suggest that the size somehow may be controlled by this phenomenon.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
And the width of this halo is about less than zero?
Yeah, so let me, so this is, I'll get that in the next slide. So this is our schematic of these kind of membranes, right? You have one rod length thick membrane, they're untwisted in the middle, and then the edge looks like this. It's a spherical edge, right? And so you can actually do, you can do a theoretical analysis of this. You can write a very simple free energy, where you have theta, which is the local tilt of the molecules, and far away from the edge, the rod wants to be perpendicular to the interface. So that's analogous to external magnetic field. So that's a C sine square theta. And then you have a twist term, right? And then you have some boundary condition at the edge. And this is a very simple thing that's just straight out of Degen. And you can solve it analytically. And you get some kind of twist penetration length, right? Which is the ratio of the twist constant to this external magnetic field. If you, you know, if you convolve this raw data with some kind of point spread function, you get which accounts for the limited resolution of your microscope. You get experimental data points, and you get a theoretical fit to agree very nicely with one another. And so from here, you can directly measure the twist penetration length, which is 0.48 microns. And this is an important material parameter for this membrane.
So what's the length of this? The virus is much more.
The length of the virus is the diameter or the length? 1 micron.
So the twist penetration is half of the length?
Yes.
Nothing.
It's very short. It's, yeah.
So it's like you cannot even talk about, I think, this kind of continuum.
Well, I mean, the diameter is what matters, right? The diameter is 7 nanometers.
And it was staying there. Accurate picture.
So this is the direct kind of EM confirmation that these kind of edges actually do have a curved structure. And so here you can see a membrane that's coming out of here, and we cut it, and it's actually 100 nanometers thick. And so most of the time rods are at some random angle, and so you will not see them because you're looking at a projection. But here you can see actually these dots at the edge, and that means that the rod, you're right looking along the rod length. And here, it's one rod length again, and the rods lie in the plane of the screen, right? And you can kind of imagine that. So this gives you another confirmation that this is the structure of the edge.
Have you played with the rod resistance length in this case? I mean, are these shift rods or flexible rods?
They're wall type.
You can tune it.
Yes.
Are these on the stiff side or the
These are on the flexible side, and if you have them stiffer, then you require less osmotic pressure to condense the rods.
And so you see the change of the slack?
If they're stiffer, we actually see the length increase. That's something that we don't understand. It's not obvious. I mean, why?
Because that would be
one would need a microscopic theory for the twist elastic constant.
Do you have a way to see whether this turning is in the same chiralid or chiralid direction if you go all the way around?
So for chiral rods, for achiral rods, they can be in both directions.
Yes, but for a particular,
actually, I don't have images here, but under certain conditions, you can see them switch direction.
You can see defects.
And you can see defects, and so the other thing that's important is, besides analyzing the structure of these edges, is the fluctuations, right? So these are very significant fluctuations of the membrane. And so they're just molecules coming from the bulk to the edge and coming back. So this indicates, this large fluctuations indicate that the line tension is very low of this edge, right?
I didn't know that it's molecule coming and not undulations.
Well, I'll analyze it. So if it's surface tension term that scales as 1 over Q squared, then,
and what's the time scale of fluctuation?
This is, you know, roughly live, maybe sped up a few times, but
so seconds?
Yes. We actually recently have some dynamics on this fluctuation. So you analyze this, you know, straight out of, you know, this is, even I could do something like this. You describe the interface in terms of some kind of function h of x, which you decompose into Fourier components. The simplest kind of free energy functional you can imagine is something like this. So you just take a bunch of images, you calculate A of Q, and you calculate the fluctuations around the mean. And the prediction for a simple interface controlled by a line tension, by surface tension, where we did A squared Q squared times Q squared is equal to 1 over line tension. And so you can do that fairly easily. And this is the fluctuation spectra that we see. You should ignore everything above this point because they're just experimental noise. at very high Q, you can't really distinguish the conformation of the membranes. So at very low Q, you see that they saturate, right? So that's indicating that that the fluctuations are controlled by some kind of surface tension, right? But then if you start increasing Q, you see that the fluctuations are significantly suppressed. And that is probably due to the bending fluctuations, right? And so if you think about this edge, as you approach the edge, as the rods are tilting, as they're tilting, you're creating a one-dimensional pneumatic. And this pneumatic has some kind of elastic constant. And that's responsible for suppression of fluctuations at high Q.
So this should be Q to the minus 4, then?
Well, I'm just plotting here A squared times Q squared. So this is Q, 1 over Q. This is 1 over Q squared, and this is 1 over Q 4. And that's actually the fit of the function. And so you can...
So will it cross over? It fits everything?
Yes.
Yes. Gamma Q squared plus...
Yes, this is the fit of the function. So we take something like this, and this term is related to the line tension, and this term is related to some kind of effective elasticity of the edge, which dominates at high Qs.
So I mean, might it come back up for very large Q fluctuations?
That's just noise. At some point, your resolution is limited. You can't resolve the fluctuations of the interface.
And in measurement, it's just reflecting your measurement in certain
Q. Yeah. So if I were to take just a flat interface that's not fluctuating, and if I were to take a bunch of images, that would still have some fluctuation spectra, and this fluctuation spectra would increase as 1 over Q, would increase as Q squared, so it would be flat like this and just go up. So that just noise superimposed. So that just tells us, to this point, we can trust our data.
Your pixel size is probably 100 nanometers or
yes,
100.
Yes, yes.
So that's where it stops, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can resolve it to less than 100 nanometers because you do Gaussian fits, but I mean, you can resolve it with atomic accuracy. So things get really interesting once you make these rods chiral, right? If you have achiral rods, I can keep adding these rods and I can assemble a monolayer, and this monolayer can assemble forever. There's no frustration in the system. Now, if you make rods chiral, things become more interesting, as you know, Greg and Robin showed before, is that you get frustration, right? So you can add one rod, and then the second rod, by chiral, I mean that they want to be slightly tilted with respect to one another. I add a second rod, and it's slightly tilted. And then I add a third rod, and the tilt just keeps increasing, right? At some point, I can't keep adding rods and tilting the rods and assembling a monolayer. So you have to untwist the rods if you want to assemble a monolayer. And so the system is frustrated. It wants to twist, it wants to assemble into membranes. And so this is just a little diversion that shows you that we can control the chirality of the virus, right? And so this is an FD virus. Chirality is one of these very difficult subjects that nobody understands really how it works. But we just utilize the fact that, you know, we see that these rods are chiral. So when they come together, they want to be slightly, they prefer not to be perfectly parallel to one another, but slightly tilted with respect to one another. And in pneumatic liquid crystals, the consequence is that a pneumatic director is going to rotate by some wave vector, Q. And so here you can really see these rods, and these rods point in this direction. And then if we change the orientation of the rods, this is going to twist in this direction. This is also seen in this image. And this is a characteristic cholesteric pitch, is you can see this bright line, and that's the rods pointing in the plane of the, lying in the plane of the screen, so the birefringence is large. And then when it gets darker, the rods point into the plane of the screen. And so the spacing tells you what is the characteristic twist between the rods. And it's very, very small. It's of the order of a fraction of a degree. So this is 20 microns, right? And the spacing is 10 nanometers. So this twist is very, very subtle effect. But something that was surprising to us is that this twist depends highly on the temperature. So in general, our system is athermal. You know, we look at the isotropic pneumatic phase transition, and it's just temperature independent. The only thing that seems to depend a lot on temperature, and that probably has to do with some kind of internal structure of the rod changing, is the twist. So at room temperature, you have the periodicity, and this periodicity has certain value. And then if you increase the temperature, you see that the periodicity increases by quite a bit. And so you can characterize this by some kind of wave vector, and you can measure that wave vector as a function of temperature. And then above 60 degrees, it's just pneumatic.
Can you crack by pressure? Can you shift everything or crack by increasing power of pressure?
These experiments are just done in bulk pneumatic liquid crystals. This is just a cholesteric phase. This is just showing you that I can tune the chirality of the rods by changing the temperature.
No, there's no polymer.
But presumably, if that happens in the bulk liquid crystal, it will also happen in these kind of structures. And so below at 60 degrees, it becomes chiral, and its chirality increases. And I think John Toner is actually, we didn't think about this, points that if you fit this, it's exactly like a power law with a 1/2 exponent. We have no idea why this happens. And for the rest of this talk, the only thing that's important is that at high temperature, the system is achiral, and as you decrease the temperature, the system becomes more chiral. And we know the relationship between the chirality and the temperature.
I saw there was a theory by Lubensky which tries to relate the macroscopic picture of a cholesteric. It's very complex, but have you tried to see if that might work?
The theory basically says you have a pitch which we don't understand, and then we have this very complicated biaxial correlations which you don't understand, and they are related to one another. But I don't think the theory really tells you, you know,
there isn't a theory of liquid crystals which tells you that the cholesteric pitch is going to vanish at some temperature.
Okay, but supposedly you start with Lubensky theory, could you get a temperature dependence out of it?
I don't think it's at that stage where you can do that.
But temperature dependence is temperature dependence of property of.
I think what's happening here is that the virus, as you decrease the temperature.
I appreciate that. But the relationship between the microscopic pitch and the macroscopic pitch is quite complex. So you would imagine measuring the microscopic pitch and then watching what happens with the macroscopic pitch.
Okay.
Well, how do I measure microscopic pitch?
With electromicroscopy, I imagine, or so.
What we believe is the origin of this pitch is that as you decrease the temperature, at high temperature the rod exists in a straight conformation. At low temperature, it has a helical ground state. Okay, but this helix is very, very floppy. So whenever you do EM, you're just going to completely wash out that structure.
You're saying you do not know what. Okay, now I understand your comment. You do not know what a microscopic pitch is.
I do not know.
Because that would be extremely interesting to.
Yes.
Because Lubensky's theory has never been tested.
Yes, I mean that's one of the reasons why we started working with the bacterial flagella, because there we know what a microscopic pitch is.
Okay.
But then you get a completely different behavior there.
Thanks.
But presumably you can shift this transition temperature by tuning your stiffness of the rods.
Yeah, we haven't done that yet, but I mean, this is an extremely important knob for our experiments, and hopefully I can show you that later. So the main kind of point that I think is okay is that we say that there is an effective line tension associated with this edge, and for achiral rods, this is always going to be positive, right? Because rods don't want to be at the edge, right? They want to be surrounded by its neighbors. But if you introduce the chirality, what happens is that in the bulk of the sample, rods need to untwist. So that costs me energy. While the rods at the edge are free to twist, right? And so that presumably should add some kind of, that should reduce the cost of the edge. The free energy of the edge, right? If I make these rods more twisted, you know, it costs me more energy to untwist them in the bulk, so they want to go to the edge.
Shouldn't it be a bulk term rather than a line tension? Shouldn't it be a bulk term rather than a line tension?
proportion of the free
energy? Well, I mean, isn't the free energy...
condensation energy you're losing in the middle.
Right? Well, I mean, isn't the edge, isn't the line tension the free energy?
But there's a correlation length from the edge that if you go deep enough from the edge, you don't know about the
penetration
edge.
That
is for chiral rods, that you have this penetration. When you have chiral rods, and
the chiral rods have their own characteristic landscape that's still like small.
Which is the pitch, and if that's what you're going to see, will you see it inside the pitch here?
Yeah, so let me show you the data. So this is the line tension that we measure using the fluctuation analysis. And this is the temperature. And so the temperature I showed you before is related directly to the chirality, right? So at very high temperature, the system is achiral, and the line tension is very high. It's about 600 kBT per micron, right? And now I start decreasing the temperature. And so as I decrease the temperature, I'm increasing the chirality, and I measure the line tension. And I see that the line tension drops down quite significantly from 600 kbt to, you know, a few hundred, to around 100 kbt, right? So this is very different from most systems. In most systems, you know, the slope would be in this direction. Now I can do it at different polymer concentrations. And so you can see at high polymer concentration, the bare line tension, this is high polymer concentration, the bare line tension is very high. As I start decreasing the polymer concentration, the bare line tension, which is the line tension in achiral limit, becomes much lower. But in each case, with increasing the chirality, the line tension decreases a lot.
So is the power spectrum still the same?
Yes, it's exactly the same. And the elastic energy and the Q squared part, or Q to the fourth part, does not change at all. And the twist penetration length doesn't change at all.
So how you would expect the twist to extend deeper into the material?
The twist penetration length doesn't depend on Q. It just depends on the elastic constant and the C, K22 and C.
Because you pack them so close.
Yes.
The pitch and the edge is completely unrelated to what you actually want.
So now you have... Now I know what gamma bare is, and I know what gamma at certain chirality is, and I can calculate what is gamma chiral, and I can calculate it.
So at the end of the point is where the whole thing falls apart?
I'll show you in the next slide what happens.
When you go down.
Yes. But what I can do is I can calculate gamma chiral for different dextrin concentrations, and I can see that they all scale on top of one curve, and it scales as 1 over Q squared, or Q squared, minus Q squared. And that's something that theoretically, you know, we've tried to model, and most of our model says that it should depend linearly on Q, and that's something, you know, that quantitatively we really don't understand yet. So the interesting part, of course, is this is 300 kBT, can you make this so large that gamma effective becomes zero? So we have a membrane at high temperature, we decrease the temperature, and we increase the chirality, right? And so what happens is the fluctuations of the edge start increasing as I'm decreasing the temperature, and then the whole interface becomes unstable. And you get a structure that has all edges, okay? And then I increase the temperature, and it's completely same. And actually, what you see here is that two of these ribbons join together, and then it's a ring, and then, you know, that's topologically constrained, and you can't,
It's a type 2 superconductor.
Huh?
It's a type 2 superconductor with a vortex.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'll come back to that.
What is it? Pitch scale as we go to temperature, how does pitch scale compare to this picture?
It's non-trivially.
Non-trivially meaning it's always smaller?
The pitch, I mean, we have detailed data on how the pitch changes varying concentrations. And, you know, and that's something that we spend the last 2 years trying to quantitatively model. And at this point, we just had to give up. And, you know, my students need jobs, and we need to publish a paper that's just a purely experimental paper. We don't understand it.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I can show you the data.
It's not experimental. It's monotonic with temperature. You're showing it was going up with temperature.
Yes.
In a bulk.
Wait, what's going up with temperature?
The pitch.
I can show you the data. I don't have it in this PowerPoint. We have detailed data on how it depends on the bare line tension, which is the osmotic pressure, and it doesn't depend a lot on Q.
So this quantity is more or less 1 kVT per 10 nanometers, right?
Yes.
It's order of magnitude.
Yes.
This 10 nanometers is what? Is the distance? How should I think about this distance?
10 nanometers is, you know, is the diameter of the rod, so it's the distance between the rods, yes.
I had another comment. The behavior similar to this in two-dimensional systems is seen in the OPG vesicles, where as you change the temperature, it's like if their line tension would vanish, and you see lots of
completely branched systems came out of the vesicle.
So, and as you scan the temperature, you first see these completely branched structures, and when it goes through that critical temperature gap, the vesicle reconstitutes at the same place with the same topology. So it reminds of it's kind of a three-dimensional version with a two-dimensional object of what's going on in here.
You return your bearing sample at that temperature
rather than changing? I'll come to that. Can
we see it again?
Huh?
Can we see it again?
By the way, does it never break into? So you have a kind of a relay like instability. Or twisted.
It's twisted ribbon, yeah.
It never breaks into where pinches.
I'll show you later on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very elastic.
In the movie, we seem to see kind of structure in some spatial scale. Is it just aberration of a movie, or there is some spatial scale?
Spatial scale with respect to the twist of the...
No, the texture.
You mean this stuff? These are actually, you know, fluctuations of the raw of the director away from the normal.
I see.
And we've actually studied that, and we observe a lot of data that, you know, you would think a monolayer of rods is very easy to understand, but there's a lot of stuff there that we don't understand.
How do you form the handle and change temperature? The pitch changes, and so should it be a tension in it? So does it begin to, like, do you have a twist going into rough?
A twist going into these samples I've one counted, and there is about 13 or 14 different states that you can observe, and they all are, you know, very complicated topology, and we don't understand a lot of them. We can actually see these things twist around one another to make a double helical structure. So it's a very, you know, I'm just trying to. So what you can do is, what happens if you prepare a sample at low bare line tension at low temperature? What you see initially is formation of these kind of small disks, right? And that are of the order of the penetration length. And so they'll hang around for a while, and they won't. But what happens eventually is that these disks will locally coalesce and start to form this kind of double twisted ribbon. And if you wait for a long time, you get these ribbons that go on forever. So here the rod points in this direction. Here the rod points in this direction. And so you go, you have something like this. And this is very robust assembly. I mean, you can get these structures to be millimeters long.
They
sediment to the bottom, and then I think because they're so large, there's some van der Waals interaction between them, so they start condensing between themselves.
But this image is on dry sample.
No, this is all in solution. We don't do anything dried, because if you dry it out, then you start doing nanotechnology or something.
So are these ribbons similar to the Prost-Helfrich ribbons? they looked at strips where you put in chirality and it causes, it looks very similar to that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a number of theories of ribbons. So what actually is, so I'll come to that in the next slide. So here you can see you can go in the other direction where you have a twisted ribbon and then increase the temperature and it goes back up into, So what's different about, so in retrospect is that the director field here is inhomogeneous, right? So I think most theories before did not account for the fact that when you come to the edge, the director field changes.
No.
And so that, introduces another complication factor, right? And in view of the structure of the flat disks, it makes sense that, that's the structure of the edge in this particular case. So the theory is actually quite a bit more complicated. And something that you need to do is you need to assume, to get any stability, even qualitatively, you need to assume that this monolayers want to have negative Gaussian modulus.
So the pitch of this helical structure is determined somehow?
Here's some data. We have more data. Here's the bare line tension. This is the pitch of the structure and the width of the structure. So you can see that the pitch changes. The width doesn't change all that much.
Chiral ribbons like these often compete with untwisted but riding flat ribbons, which, like in a barber pole,
yes,
it's impossible because it's lying on the surface. You couldn't get a barber pole.
We've seen some of that in the past, but not as reproducibly. This definitely seems to be a lower energy state.
But is it plastic on the surface?
No, they're in solution.
They're in solution?
Yes. The other thing that you can do is, you can take one of these membranes and you can start manipulating it. So this is a flat two-dimensional membrane. And so we have a laser tweezer that has two points. And this laser, and then we start stretching it. And as you start stretching it, it's going to spontaneously twist. And you can really stretch it. It's a very elastic object, and it's completely reversible. And so it's stretched, and then we release it at some point. And here you're directly grabbing the tweezer. Something that makes quantitative data analysis more complicated here is that there's also, when you do this, you exert a torque on it. So it's not a free boundary condition. But in principle, we can get data like this that tells you what is the force extension curve. So you have a force, you have an extension. At high bare concentration, you see that the force increases linearly, and then there's this other regime where it's very easy to stretch it. But then if you're close to the transition, you see that as you stretch it, the force actually decreases and you have a metastable state here. So in principle, I think, and that's something that we are starting to do this summer, is you can measure the whole free energy landscape of this to ribbon transition, and we hope to do that. Do I have 10 more minutes?
Sure.
What time? Okay. So part three is defects. So defects, there's really, a lot of defects in this membrane, and I'll just focus on one of them. If you have two of these membranes and they want to coalesce, you get in trouble, right? Because here, the rods point in this direction. Here, the rods point in this direction. If they come together, I need to expel this twist. So how does this happen? So here we have two membranes. We actually brought them together with a laser tweezer. And so the way it happens is you form this little neck, which is actually just part of a little ribbon. So here the rods point in this direction. Here they point in this direction. And here they point in this direction. And then the thing just gets completely expelled, right? Now, if you want to do this, you can't do this all the time, right? Especially, for example, if I take two membranes and put them on a surface, I cannot do this, right? And so what happens if they're on the surface? Here, again, they're on the surface, so they can't perform that maneuver. So instead of forming that, you know, instead of doing that, you you get some kind of defect, and over a long period of time, this kind of smaller droplet, because of the difference in Laplace pressure, is gonna the material is gonna flow from here to here, and you actually have these kind of interesting defects in the middle, which are some kind of pores. I will not talk about them, but they're very interesting in its own right.
Unstable.
Huh?
Unstable.
Yeah, it will stay like that for months. So what is the structure of this kind of defect, which we call a pie wall? It's essentially something like this. So here you have rods that point into the plane of the screen, and you twist by 180 degrees, and here they point into the plane of the screen. So it's like a, it's more like a vortex line in a superconductor.
Is that twist plane boundary?
What do you mean by that?
Well, there are special semantics.
They would have to be at an angle, I think. And here they're flat in 2D. So I think that's the difference. So then an interesting thing is that, you know, so here you can see fluorescence. You can see a rod here pointing into the plane of the screen. This is a pie wall. And here you can see a rod lining in the plane of the screen. And here you see the polarization, right? And so if, you know, as the rods tilt, the polarization increases, right? The birefringence increases. If this thing is of constant thickness, you would expect that the birefringence would just increase. But you can clearly see that in the middle of it, it actually becomes darker. And the reason for that is that the thickness of the membrane decreases. And so you can quantitatively model that. So we assume, and this is supported by theoretical calculation, is far away, this twist decreases exponentially, and then you have a linear region here. And then we know what the birefringence of the particle is and everything else. And then you can fit the data to experimental model very well, assuming that the thickness changes, and the thickness actually decreases by quite a bit. It goes from, you know, 880 nanometers to less than 400 nanometers. So the structure really looks something like this. You know, the thickness, it's much thinner in the middle.
Is drug mobility also slowed down there?
We haven't studied that, but it's essentially, you know, this is a smectic, but here you have a one-dimensional pneumatic, right, as you tilt the rods. Now, at some point, you might expect you have a pie wall, you have an energetic cost of a pie wall, right? And then you have two separate edges, right? And so we can calculate the fluctuations of a pie wall, and we can calculate the fluctuations of the free edges, right? And you know, this is the fluctuation spectra of a free edge that I've shown you before. This is a fluctuation spectra of a pie wall. We have this mysterious bump again. We don't understand the physics behind this bump. But, you know, from this low Q limit, we can still extract some kind of line tension. And so you can measure the line tension of a pie wall and a line tension of an edge, right? So at high temperature, they're both equal energetics. And then as you go down, the energetics of the pie wall decreases much faster. The energetics of the edge, the line tension of the edge decreases much faster than the line tension of a pie wall, right? So at this point, it costs you 200 kBT per micron to make an edge, and it costs you more than 400 microns to make a pie wall. So at some point, you might assume that if you decrease the polymer, the line tension, that the thing will want to prefer to make two edges, and that this pie wall will just fall apart.
This is a function of what?
This is a function, sorry, I cut, as a function of temperature, the chirality. So at high chirality, at low chirality, the line tension is kind of the same.
Is it 60 degrees when chirality?
disappears altogether, the place where they cross, is it 16 degrees?
Yeah, roughly. I would have to check.
But does it depend on pressure, polymer pressure?
Yes, it will. This is for one specific polymer pressure.
The temperature.
Polymer pressure or polymer polymer concentration?
Polymer concentration. So what happens is you know, something completely different happens where, you know, you have this one-dimensional pi wall, and as you increase the temperature, what actually happens is that you get a crystallization into kind of one-dimensional swollen smectics. So instead of it falling apart, it actually just crystallizes. And these are pores. These are highly swollen pores. And you know, again, it's very interesting to know what's happening.
Before you start to see the droplets, could there already be a microstructure in your pi wall along the wall? Is the pi wall translationally invariant?
Yes, because from the fluorescence microscopy, we see these rods diffuse up and down. But here, you'll actually see smectic layers, and you'll see rods stay in the layer.
So the pi wall is absolutely translation invariant.
Yes.
You don't see any periodicity even before the
Yes. You know, these are the kind of things that, you know, I think one could do a lot of interesting physics on. Here you have an array of interacting pi walls. You can see their fluctuations. They clearly repel one another. You know, you can see individual rods. You can see orientational fluctuations. So, you know, there's just a lot of kind of physics that one could study with this. Yeah, you can see if you catch it. Yes, if you can see, can you see a rod here? It's a little bit elongated, and you'll see that, you know, it escapes a pi wall. So this is my next to last slide. The other thing that an interesting way that you can make these pi walls is you can just take a laser tweezer, and you can just kind of draw them in a membrane, and you know, and so you can make various kind of fancy configurations. Here you have a pi wall, kind of eye structure embedded in a membrane.
Wait a minute. What did you just do then?
I took a laser tweezer.
Yes.
And I just pulled the laser tweezer across the membrane.
And tell me how that makes a pi. Yeah.
Makes a neutral line of neutral material in between.
I have no idea.
At least it might make two, but it can't make one because you've got an 180 degree turn on either side of the pipe.
But you have
those two, the molecules on the top and the bottom, have not had 180 degrees twist between them.
Yeah, so there's actually good reason to believe that this once you have a pi wall, it's a one-dimensional like Mobius strip, and the Mobius strip is all concentrated on this edge. I would be happy to discuss this with you later on. I can show you a more detailed movie of how this makes. The way
it's obviously made something, but you're sure that isn't two pi walls, for instance, or something
else
again.
So you can, the way it does it is it folds, it takes this thing and it folds it on itself.
Yeah.
And so you really get, we believe, you get a Mobius-like structure, and then these two.
But the point is that the pi wall is a topological defect.
Yes.
With 180 degrees rotation between here and here.
Yes.
And without rotating half of those molecules, I can't put in a 180 degree turn asymptotically between a molecule up here and a molecule down there because they haven't. There wasn't.
Yeah, but I can take this thing, and the laser tweezer actually.
Okay. So within that strip.
Yeah.
You put in this.
Yes. Yes. I have a better movie.
Because you cut and pasted, basically.
Yes.
You can match that 180 degrees onto this one. Right, okay. Right, so it really is surgery. So
it's a surgery.
Yes.
Just along that part and reattach, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it propagates from there to the ball?
There must be sort of a defect in each and at the beginning of the end point.
It has to be attached at the edge. If we were to release the laser tweezer here, it would just go back up. I can show you a movie. This is another example where, you know, you break a pi wall, now you have this kind of circle, and, you know, it interacts with this pi wall, and so you can, you know, stretch it and do all kinds of things. So I hope I've convinced you that this is a very rich system. I started studying this 10 years ago. At that point, I published a few papers because I wanted to get a job, but those papers were just really a zoology. I think at this point, we are starting to understand some of the basic physics. The next challenge is to really put in the numbers, and that's actually, we tried to do that for a few cases. And you know, we can measure a lot of the constants that go into the theoretical models, and that's been done by Bob Meyer and Bob Pelkowitz. And there's a large discrepancy, so that's really still a challenge. But this is an example of a hierarchical assembly. So we would really like to understand this at multiple levels, right? So what we started with is we started with DNA and a major code protein, and these things assemble into these viruses that we like very much. They're monodispersed, and we can tune a lot of the parameters now. You know, we can tune the chirality, we can tune we can tune the persistence length, we can tune the aspect ratio. We are right now, one of my students is making incorporating all the genome of these rods into bacteria, so that making these rods is going to be extremely easy. It's going to be just taking some E. coli and growing it. And since all the genetic information is going to be in the DNA genome, it's going to be experimental analog of boiling an egg or something like that. So we are making a large library of the rods where we vary the aspect ratio from about 5 to about 500. And we can vary the persistence length and the chirality. So I think it's going to be, we're hoping it's going to become a useful model system.
So you vary the aspect ratio by just changing the DNA length?
Yes. The other thing that we are very interested in studying is the friction. So it's actually very difficult to get these systems to organize something like that, because it really depends on the intermolecular friction. Under these kind of conditions, these rods are free to rearrange locally and to form this kind of equilibrium structures. But under many different conditions, these rods are just going to come together and they're going to irreversibly stick to one another, and they will not be able to locally rearrange at all. And that creates a lot of problems. They'll form some kind of non-equilibrium gel-like phase. So we're interested in studying the friction and how it relates to microscopic properties. And then, once you understand this at a pair level, you can, assemble these rods that, make these ribbons, and then you can go on. You can take a ribbon, you can make a circle or all kinds of different structures. In many ways, this is so robust that now you have a supermolecular polymer, that you can do all kinds of things with. So with that,
is this dimension here?
This is 1 micron, but we actually could make them down to three. We have mutant rods that are 300 nanometers, so we can tune the thickness of this, of this membrane. You can ask how that affects persistence length and things like that. With that, I thank you for your attention. I'm sorry.
Would you mind to tell us more about friction?
No, I would be happy. So this is the kind of experiment. How are we doing on time? I completely lost track. I figured.
We usually have seminar until noon, so.
Okay.
Don't worry. For friction, we have time.
So the most interesting part about friction experiments is that they are very dependent on the orientation. So actin is a polar molecule, and we can pull them in one direction and we can pull them in the other direction, and the friction coefficient is going to change by 100% at least. We've done it a lot for one direction, and my student is right now taking data for the other direction. So I don't know what the implications of that are. but it sounds interesting. So, you know, actin is a polar molecule, right? So you can think of it as something like this.
You're talking about left versus right.
So you can have them, yeah, you can have them, you can pull them in this direction.
So which, right? Which way is the higher friction?
The higher friction is when two barbed ends, that's the easier. When we have, let me think about this. So we have a filament, we have something like this. So it would be anti-parallel.
Is the high friction.
And
the case you showed or another case?
Well, there's another case that you can make these rods. There's actually, I think.
You can pull them either way, though.
Huh?
If they're anti-parallel, you can pull one to the right or one to the left. They're different. Since they're polar.
Yes, yes.
So you actually have three.
Yeah, yeah, we can only do two experiments.
But you have actually three possible frictions.
Yes, yes, yes.
The wrong direction in the anti-parallel.
So you could, you know, you could pull them in this direction, you can pull them in this direction.
Are those?
Those are the two experiments we do. Uh-huh. We can't do the other. The third experiment we can't do because of the geometry.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there is presumably a third friction.
Yes. Yes.
Which of these two you do? Which of these two?
Well, I mean, you know, I really don't know how to relate this to the structure of the filament. You know, I don't know if, you know, in this direction we see, so this is the barbed end, right? And this is the barbed end. You know, I don't know if I should draw the filaments this way or if I should flip them around.
You're talking about pulling barbed ends forward. Is the
I can either do this or I can do this experiment.
Barbed end is not trailing, it's one way, the barbed end is forward. Exactly.
Yes.
And which friction is higher?
This friction is the highest.
No, but you can pull it in two directions.
Oh, yes, so I can do this? Okay, just 1 second. Okay, I can. The other experiment is something like this.
No, but it's two. It's the highest top picture. The top picture you can pull into the direction.
Yes, yes, yes.
So can you tell us which direction is going?
I can do.
Give him a chance.
He always pulls, just touches the beam.
I can do this experiment, and then I can pull here, right? Those are the two experiments that, and so in, now I don't know if I should draw these in this, you know, presumably this is the higher friction, but I should draw them in a different way.
Another way to think about it is that friction this way or this way is different, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But if they were like that, the lower one would definitely have higher.
So here's
the actual geometry of those things.
Yeah, I
stuck face to face in the lower one and just sawtooth glide over the top one. Just a matter of drawing.
Yeah, so I can show you some raw data. We don't think they do because we can attach a control bead at one end and we don't see the twisting around.
Like the curls you did from all before, minus an actin.
So can you actually see, because these two experiments, whatever you see, whatever difference you see is a sort of a non-equilibrium effect, right? So
yes.
If you look at the rate dependence, you should, if you do it slower and slower, you should see that they should converge.
Why should they converge?
Friction is not. It's not, but what I'm saying is that, you know, thermodynamically,
it's very difficult to do these things at, you know, very low velocity because you have all kinds of drifts in your experimental setup, and so that becomes, you know, it's very difficult to say whether you're moving the filaments or whether you are, you know.
Your barrier to the left can be different than the barrier to the right.
That's right. The barrier is different, but thermodynamics is the same.
Yes, exactly. Once you stop moving, it should go to thermal equilibrium,
right,
and it shouldn't distinguish between left, at least in the large and limit, as sure I will assure us.
There shouldn't be any static friction on it anyway.
That's right.
But you can't do the parallel orientation.
Not with the kind of setup we have right now, okay. But I mean, eventually.
Because it is actually still an interesting number.
Yes.
Is friction dependent on the force that presses one against the other, or on the pressure, which means whether it depends on the amount of overlap?
So let me show you what the data looks like.
Okay.
So this is the experiment that we do, right? So we have two beads, we have two filaments, and you have an overlap length, right? And so what we do is we pull this bead at a constant velocity v, and we measure the force here, right? And so this is, you know, I've showed this movie before. This is a movie again. We just need to get them into the right conformation for that to use flow. And so now we start doing the experiment, and you can see that, you know, the as we are pulling it, the thing falls apart. So this is an example of raw data, right? This is the time, and we are pulling this at certain velocity, which is probably 50 nanometers per second.
So you control velocity, not force.
Yeah, we could, in principle, do force experiments, but we haven't. This is all the experiments we've done so far is velocity. So the force, you know, there's some slack in the system, and it needs to you need to build up the tension. So you did it very quickly, and then it just flat for a long time until you reach some critical, you know, length scale, at which time it starts dropping down exponentially.
And is that like half the overlap? Is that the overlap in halfway?
So when the
force, I'll show that.
When the force is flat, there's still the overlapping length is increasing,
right?
Yes. 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 So
it's amazing.
So
it's not friction. It's not friction.
No, it is friction.
Why?
Well,
it's not friction.
The force doesn't change you as a leg over a leg.
Well,
this
says
yes.
No,
I'm just showing the data at this point.
Do we have a high school physics book that you need? As long as the F is proportional to V, I think it's friction.
It's not proportional.
It's not proportional to V.
Let me show the data.
V is constant and F is constant.
This was at 50 nanometers per second. This is pulled at 200 nanometers per second, right? And so you can see that it's constant, but you can see that the force, I'm pulling four times higher, the force hardly increases, right? And then it just drops down very quickly, right?
Yeah.
And so,
pull up, there's no dependence on
that. Did you talk about also against the overlap?
Yes. So this is the force of the plateau region versus velocity. And this is, you know, force. And we can fit it with this kind of relationship, which I guess, you know, people have done for atomic friction before. Yeah, the force is very large. It's, you know, it's 10, you know, it's 5-10 piconewtons, and then we can repeat it at different osmotic pressure, and then you can see that it increases much more, you know, but it still can be described by the same formula. And then at the highest osmotic pressure, it really becomes very high. It's, you know, tens of piconewtons. This is 2.5, 3, and 3.5. percent polyethylene glycol.
So it changes linear in the pressure.
I haven't plotted that yet. I'm not sure. We haven't done that, but that's. I mean, we should do that.
So there is a length associated with the energy barrier, right? Okay? And the length goes decreases as your pressure increases.
Say that again. Yes. So that's data over here, right? So this is F over F max averaged over many data runs. And so this is a three different, this is the function of the overlap length, right? So this is at three different polymer concentrations. And so that's the data. That's the data for one orientation, and we are right now getting. This just tells you that, you know, for overlap lengths above, you know, 400 microns, the force is independent of overlap length. And then there is certain critical distance at which point it starts depending on the overlap length. And this depends on the pressure, right? And so at very high pressure, this characteristic length scale is maybe micron or 2 microns. At lower pressure, it's, you know, 4 or 5 microns.
And it could come from fluctuations, maybe, that at low pressure you have some sort of it's possible.
I don't know how to interpret this.
So one possible interpretation is that you only are feeling each other at some distance, and the rest of it is not fixed.
Yes. Yes.
If they're bubbles, Michael, then it will screen simply, and at some point it will go into better plants.
Yeah, that means that there's basically a single point controlling the.
Not point, but like.
Yeah, but why is it a single thing? I would consider a micron pretty big.
Well, I mean, these
are. It should be some.
What is the reference of undulations?
It's an atomistic line.
What is the reference of undulations?
Undulations?
No, but it's
nothing to do with in you mean of the bubbles?
Of the bubbles.
But then it's probably. On the length.
I think you have microscopic roughness, and probably there's a single point that's.
But a point is not a micron.
Yeah, it's an atomistic scale.
Big point. Why is it a micron? Why is it a micron?
The point
is it's huge. See, it's way beyond a micron scale.
So they need to interact over a certain length scale, I think. And.
Well, they don't interact beyond someone.
Yes.
At least in terms of kinetics, if it's a barrier crossing process, that, and if it doesn't depend on the length of the overlap, that means that it's a fixed small distance that controls.
It does depend on the length of the overlap when that gets below micron.
So if you below a certain limit, you can get maybe fluctuation of
one. Is there any tendency for the filaments to wrap around each other?
We haven't seen that, you know. I mean, we kind of looked for that, but these things just, you know, they really just come together, and the forces are so enormous that they cannot locally rearrange at all.
So they can't even match each other's rules somehow?
Well, actually, that's very interesting. Actin is very unique in that way that, you know, a myosin needs to walk on actin, and it needs to have a binding site available to it. And people say that actin, the helical grooves of actin, are very soft. So it can very easily adjust its helical grooves.
Okay.
And so
there is some adjustment.
So it's easy to imagine that, you know, these helical grooves can adjust, you know, to interpenetrate over a certain length scale.
That's what they take a role in.
Interestingly, if we do these experiments for microtubules, it just, the friction is, you know, 4 orders of magnitude lower.
Have you tried for DNA?
No.
It's more flexible.
No.
There are experiments that have taken DNA and wrapped it around the 4 optical trap experiment. Actually, my colleagues downstairs announced them.
I don't recall what I
was going to ask you. Have you compared with that?
They've used cross-linking proteins, right?
No, but they also just looked at their DNA where they have 4 trap experiments.
Yes.
And they could wrap 2 strands of DNA around each other, I think, some number of times.
Yes.
And then pull the appropriate.
Oh, actually, I don't. Okay.
And watch. I don't recall the details.
Is this published or?
Oops. Maybe not. I don't know. I thought so.
It probably depends on the length, right?
And these are two double-stranded.
Yeah, actually, you know, you can do hybrid bundles, right? So, like actin on FD is again gonna, you know, that's not so surprising. Perhaps it's gonna freely diffuse, right? Because there's no structure to match.
I think you've seen the Coulomb law actually, well, some version of that, because you're not controlling the normal force, you're controlling the osmotic pressure.
Yes.
You're controlling the length.
For unit length.
Yes.
The question is why it's not dependent on length.
Why is it flat there?
But the force also depends on the length.
Not the force, not the normal force.
Not beyond the...
That's determined by the depletion.
Micro.
If it's an interaction for human flat,
and so, and so it's, con- it's, a ma- it's like taking two blocks, or a block on a plane, but not controlling the weight of the block,
right,
but controlling only the force per unit area of overlap.
Yes.
And Coulomb's law there would say it would be proportional to area.
Correct. It's like you can increase the legs of the freight train and you can move extra records of frames.
Yeah.
There's no extra recognition.
So your experiments are performed with fluorescently
Yes, yes.
Okay. Is there any information you can get from the distribution of light along these rods as you are following it?
We actually try to do FRET experiments. It's interpreting that data is very difficult.
And just from the light distribution?
No, I mean, this is all 10 nanometers.
Your images look very saturated, right? That's how you...
No, they're not saturated. I mean, I wish they were saturated. With fluorescence, you never get saturated. I mean...
Well, it depends how you set your camera.
So yeah, I mean...
So you should have light variations. If you have significant distortions...
Yeah, but those bubbles probably have, you know, length scale of... 10, 20 nanometers, right? The interaction potential is very short range. You know, so for them to disengage, they just need to move 10, 20 nanometers.
Can you try pushing back?
You can't do that with the system because it's just too floppy. It buckles right away.
Buckles. Sub-peak on it. Way under peak.
We can actually do that with microtubules. We are doing those experiments right now. So then you can, then you can do like dynamic measurements.
Microtubules have also this plateau?
No, microtubules are completely different.
They don't have this.
No, the thing about microtubules is that they have this disordered chain attached to the surface, and people think that it's actually coated with some kind of brush. And so you can imagine that this highly negative brush actually just washes all the molecular details. And you can actually remove that brush, and then we haven't done that yet.
It also is on various binding proteins that would start maybe looking more like this case.
Yes, yes.
But it was tau.
Yes.
But with the branch, do you see the friction?
No, it just classical hydro, it scales with V, it scales with
the lubrication layer.
Yeah,
scale. And the product of the force times the length at which the sort of you have a drop in the force is not constant, seems to be, right? I mean, seems to be actually...
The product of, say that again?
Well, I mean, we saw that the level of the force changed.
Yes.
Now, also the point where the thing breaks, sort of breaks, the force goes down,
yes,
change, which is the length.
Yes.
Also changes.
With,
so the question is whether...
Yeah, that's this data.
Right, whether the energy or some kind of energy parameter is constant or not.
Work done by this friction force before it breaks.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
And you can check it.
Yes.
It'd be strange if that's independent of pressure.
So the,
let's take
I guess in this experiment, as the area changes, the pressure is constant, so the force, normal force changes, right?
The total normal force.
The total normal
force.
Per unit length, it doesn't. It shouldn't. But the total, but the Coulomb law is the total normal force? Or?
Yeah.
So the total changes.
So if there were, bubbles as ordinals.
Yes. We actually have,
with at least one micro, maybe using a fluorescent bulb would reveal it, because if it comes into the gap or not, right?
Yeah. It would be very hard, 10 nanometers.
So there are these very short, ordinary bubbles for thermal fluctuation, but they seem to have a length of 1 micron.
But I'm not surprised that these bubbles, this is a very stiff polymer, right? So, I mean, I don't know what the length scale of that bubble would be. Actually.
It would be the order deflection length.
Yes.
Resistance
yes.
to the power of 2/3 times distance to the power of 1/3. So, there is large.
Is it micro?
Yeah. That's why it's the deflection length.
It depends on the distance between these two filaments.
We actually, you know, with the
size of the tank.
Well, with the term, you can you can visualize these bubbles in a different conformation where you absorb it onto the surface, and then you look at it with a turf, and then you're very sensitive to the height, and the bubbles are of the order of micron.
Okay.
So, but I don't know how bubbles really help you.
Because you're trying to apply tension, a bubble tends to not allow tension to propagate much further.
You have several bubbles along the overlap. You still have several points of contact.
You're still getting motion
on up.
I'm not arguing for static friction.
It's almost like if you go to the microscopic level, that's when the data collapses. Exactly. That's what I was trying to say. I mean, I think one model you could have is that you have multiple sort of points of contact, and they give you different barriers to cross, and the largest barrier would be controlling. So you have to look at the barrier distribution. So you have extreme value statistics of barriers controlling this process.
Okay, let us stand.